Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
$7.4 billion, that's how much the Sackler family in the United States had to agree to pay last week to settle claims about its powerful prescription painkiller OxyContin. The deal represents an increase of more than $1 billion on a previous settlement that was rejected in 2024 by the US Supreme Court. Now, the drug has been blamed for supercharging the deadly opioid crisis in America, and it generated billions of dollars in profit for the Sackler family. But who will get the money, and where does it leave the Sackler family now? Adam McGuire from our business desk joins us. And Adam, you've been looking at all of this, and in particular the settlement. But tell us firstly about the Sackler family.
Yeah, well, the story of the Sacklers and its involvement in pharmaceuticals goes back to three brothers, Arthur, Mortimer and Raymond. They were all born in Brooklyn, the early 20th century, children of Polish and Ukrainian immigrants. They all studied medicine and they all became involved in psychiatry. Arthur, though, also worked with pharmaceutical companies through a medical advertising agency called William Douglas McAdams, which he started out writing copy for while he was studying, trying to make a bit of money. But eventually he took control of that and he really transformed the business. And it's crucial to the origin story because it's here he developed a skill for marketing medicines. He helped turn Pfizer from a chemicals company into a pharmaceuticals company. He played a major role in making Valium hugely popular in the US. It was the first drug to generate $100 million in sales back in the 60s. Part of what he did as well was he leveraged the medical newspaper that he bought called the Medical Tribune. It was popular with doctors and it became kind of a key tool for drug companies to raise awareness around their products. He was also a pioneer in direct marketing to doctors. This is the idea of sending out sales reps around the country to encourage GPs to prescribe their products. And while he's doing all that work with pharmaceutical companies, Arthur, along with his two brothers, they acquire a small drug maker called Purdue. It's been going since the 1890s. They bought it in the 50s. And for a few decades, it's a relatively small player until they acquire another company in the late 60s called Knapp Laboratories. And this is where they make their move into treating pain management.
Okay, so where does that start then?
Well, one of their first most popular medicines in this area was called MS-Contin. It was a time-release morphine, so promised to give relief of 8 to 12 hours. And at the time, just like regular morphine, it was mainly being used to treat pain management in cancer patients. And it was a fairly popular product for Purdue. It helped to grow their revenues significantly. But the fact that it was a niche product was a problem for the Sacklers because it limits the market. And they start thinking about, well, what other applications could a drug like this have? You know, why would we only need pain management for cancer patients? There are other people out there living with mild or severe pain from old injuries or wear and tear, physical labour, whatever it might be. So they're starting to look at, well, how can we expand the market here? But at the same time, the problem they face is that medical patents only last 20 years. So by the late 80s, MS-Contin is on the verge of coming out of patent and being available as a generic. Anyone can make it, essentially, which would be an existential threat to their bottom line. So they start saying, well, we need to develop a new drug to replace MS-Contin. And this is where OxyContin is developed. So it's based on an opioid called oxycodone, which is stronger than morphine. And like MS-Contin, one of the selling points of OxyContin is that it's slow release. So they say users don't get a spike of relief that quickly wears off. Its effects will last for hours. And this becomes an important point then in the approvals process for the drug.
So you might explain that for us, why that became so important.
Yeah, well, like all medicines, you need to get approval from the relevant authority before you can start actually offering it to patients and selling it. So in Ireland, we have the European Medicines Agency and the Health Products Regulatory Authority. In the US, it's the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA. And in the FDA approvals process, in this case, was handled by a man called Curtis Wright. This slow release process is seen as a protection against addiction and also a disincentive for abuse, because patients aren't going to get the same, you know, buzz from taking it as they would other types of drug where it has an immediate strong effect. But there are some serious flaws in the FDA process, and they've come to light in recent years. For example, there were no clinical tests done by the FDA to actually try and figure out whether the drug was more or less addictive or open to abuse than other opioids. It was just kind of taken on face value that this is the case. It led to a line in the label and in all the paperwork with the drug. Delayed absorption is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug. And Purdue used that as a really strong selling point for doctors and for patients as well. But Wright said it was just an opinion. He didn't actually test that. He just kind of said, well, we imagine this to be the case. And, you know, One thing that a closer examination would have discovered is that that slow release mechanism was so easy to get around. All you had to do was bite the tablet or crush it.
Because it was just the coating.
It was just a coating on the outside. So once you broke it and took it that way, you got that immediate hit from it. So it wasn't a very strong kind of protection against that fast hit. And in the book Empires of Pain about OxyContin and the Sacklers, Patrick Radden Keefe discovered that a number of people actually working for Purdue spent time with Wright to help him through his analysis of the paperwork they submitted as part of their application. Yeah, so it seemed to be a really thin line between the drug company.
They went into the FDA and they said, don't worry now, we'll help
you understand this. Yeah, we'll help you understand how this works and we'll talk you through it all and you know, make you see what the right conclusion is. A lot of people also point to the fact that Wright left the FDA after OxyContin was approved. He was hired by Purdue a year later on a much, much bigger salary than he got with the FDA. And they say that's proof of just how close that relationship was.
Right. But of course, ultimately, it was the fact that OxyContin got approved that led to it becoming a blockbuster drug, right?
Yeah. And it didn't take long for that to happen. OxyContin gets approved right at the end of 1995, hits the market in 96. Within 5 years, it's brought in revenues of $2.8 billion for Purdue Pharma. A big part of that is down to that direct marketing approach that Arthur Sackler had perfected with other pharmaceutical companies. So they employ hundreds of sales reps to go around the country and encourage doctors to prescribe the drug. And they use that FDA approval and the suggestion that it has reduced risk of abuse and addiction. And I mentioned, you know, they want this to be a drug for anyone with pain issues, not just seriously ill people. And if you've ever watched TV in the US, you'll know that drug marketing is very different there to how it is here. Ad breaks absolutely chock full of ads for prescription drugs. They make it seem like, you know, every little niggle or imperfection could be fixed with a pill. And they always end with the line, you know, ask your doctor if this drug, if OxyContin, is right for you. And it's a way of kind of getting patients to put pressure on their GPs to get some kind of prescription, and this drug in particular, rather than going and saying, well, what's the best treatment for this problem? You know, bear in mind as well that, you know, the cost of healthcare in the US is so, so high. So many people who are carrying niggles and injuries, which might be easily fixed with surgery or even a bit of physio, it's too expensive for them. So this is kind of a drug like this promises a quick fix, especially if it has that promise that, well, you're not going to get addicted to it. It's not going to be bad for you in any way. It's just going to solve that little problem you have.
And it'll deal with your
pain. Exactly, yeah.
You think, why not?
Yeah, exactly. And Purdue pushed that 12-hour of relief as you know, because it's more attractive than the alternatives. But they knew actually that it didn't offer 12 hours. It was probably closer to 8 hours, maybe even less. But they just said, no, keep pushing 12 because that will make it sell better. And instead, they encouraged doctors to prescribe stronger doses than was initially intended. And that worked, you know, because that was also good for their sales. If you sell more of the drug to each customer, to each patient. The year OxyContin hit the market, there are around 8 million opioid prescriptions in the US. That's risen to 89 million by 2010, 123 million by 2023. Not all of those, of course, OxyContin. There are other opioids on the market as well. And other pharmaceuticals came along with drugs to compete with OxyContin, which contributed to the bigger problem, but they were definitely at the fore of this push in the market.
So just going back to what you said there about doctors being encouraged to prescribe a stronger dose than was initially indicated, do we know why the doctors went along with that strategy? Were their patients so far down the road that they felt maybe compelled to?
There was an element of that, and I suppose it was an easy fix. Again, if the patient wasn't able to take any surgery or treatment, this was something that they could give them that would give them immediate relief. And I suppose then it was just a case that ratcheted up because they were being told by the drug company, we'll just up the dosage if they're still in pain, and that will solve the problem. And you know, they had that FDA approval approval telling them this is safe, it's not going to be addictive, or it's probably not going to be addictive as well. But salespeople did a very good job of playing down the negatives as well. You know, this was a quick fix. It transpired though years later that those OxyContin sales reps, you know, they were also incentivized to get more doctors to prescribe the drug because they got bonuses based on that. So they would then in turn try and encourage the doctors and incentivize it in some ways. Well, some of that was freebies or invites to medical conferences that happened to be taking place in very nice resorts
and
places like that.
Hawaii.
Yeah, there were extreme examples of what they called the whales. They were doctors who were high prescribers of this drug. They were being paid tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars to speak at these medical conferences, and essentially seen as a way of basically paying them to do this. You know, and that focus on high prescribing doctors was in part motivated by a recommendation by consultancy firm McKinsey. They were brought on to boost sales, and they said, look, these are the ones who are prescribing a lot of drugs, focus on them and get them to do more of that.
You've got to get the doctors on side. Of course, as we're talking about this, I know a lot of people will have seen this. It's been dramatised a number of times on television,
that's
hasn't
right,
it? People
yeah.
have seen
Dope Sick. Yeah.
And you mentioned the Patrick Radden Keefe book,
yeah.
which is an excellent read, if anyone wants to go and see it. But how long before people realise that this thing, this drug, OxyContin, is creating problems?
The Sacklers claim they didn't know the drug was creating problems until 2000. That was when the US attorney for Maine wrote to multiple doctors about issues around people overdosing and a rise in crime related to the drug. The truth is, though, and what's come out since then is that they knew a lot earlier than that. The problem really became apparent to those in the front line quite quickly. Those sales reps who were talking to doctors, they were hearing firsthand about patients getting addicted. They were hearing about break-ins at pharmacies. They were hearing about people dying. And they were reporting that back to their bosses. And there are emails among senior executives in Purdue talking about the abuse problem, talking about the street value of OxyContin long before 2000. Those emails also showed that they knew GPs were under the impression OxyContin was weaker than morphine, and people were encouraged, don't tell them otherwise, even though it was a lot stronger. And, you know, they were encouraging doctors to prescribe heavier doses, say, because it meant selling more drugs and making more money. And the truth is that there were a lot of doctors who kept prescribing and pharmacies dispensing long after the problems started to emerge, in no small part because of those incentives that Purdue built into their business. It's not really, though, until 2007 before there's a legal ruling against Purdue and an admission that it may have, or some of its staff may have, misled regulators, doctors and customers. Mm-hmm.
But even now and after that, so after 2007, the drug keeps selling beyond that point, right?
Yeah, it's very much that 2007 case focused on the branding and the marketing, that, you know, that the drug was missold, but there still wasn't really a full reckoning with just how dangerous it was and others like it were as well. And it's continued to generate billions for the company. Now, Purdue is privately owned, so hard to get an exact figure on how much they earn from OxyContin. They don't publish annual results like a listed company would. But from the various investigations and court cases, it's thought that they made a total of $35 billion for Purdue from that one drug by 2017. It's thought the Sacklers themselves made somewhere in the region of $11 to $13 billion from the company, which again was largely making its money from mm-hmm. OxyContin.
But now we have this settlement, the $7.4 billion, which was agreed last week. Does that bring the thing to an end?
Not really. Like, the Sacklers have made attempts at wrapping this up. You mentioned the previous settlement that was rejected by the courts. They tried to get immunity from any further prosecution. They want to wrap up Purdue in a bankruptcy so that basically it's separated from themselves. That was rejected, as I say, and it does leave the door open for other cases. So if people don't want to take the settlement, they can still sue Purdue and the Sackler family. But they've made clear that they'll fight any cases taken against them. They've never fully accepted responsibility for the harmful effects of the drug and the way that they sold it as well. At the same time, you also have somewhere in the region of 700,000 opioid-related deaths in the US, many, many more who've suffered the consequences of addiction as well. There was a 2012 study which suggested that three quarters of people seeking help for heroin addiction began by abusing prescription painkillers like OxyContin. So the harm of these drugs is you know, mm-hmm. almost impossible to quantify and ongoing as well. And the drugs are still available on the market, of course, these types of opioid. And then we hear about Donald Trump talking about fentanyl coming over the Mexican border as well. It's a massive issue still that even with the settlement is not going to go away all of a sudden.
So the settlement then, the money, the $7.4 billion, that'll be used to settle cases where individuals have taken an action against the Sackler family. Is that
yeah,
how
so
it works?
Yeah, so there's multiple states involved. So some of the money is going to states
yeah.
in order to, you know, help them deal with the crime issue
fallout.
And the health issue and everything else. Some of it is then also set aside for individual patients who join in on this settlement. But again, they have the option of not taking the settlement, but you'd have to sue the Sacklers themselves, and they've made clear that they'll fight you, basically.
And I assume that a deal was struck. The figure would have been much higher if the FDA hadn't been, you know, hadn't been doing what they were doing, bringing them into the room.
Well that's partly part of the Sackler's defence, basically, is that, look, yeah. we went through the proper process, we got this approved, and, you know, that it isn't like they, you know, circumvented the law in that sense. So that was part of the defence, that the FDA looked at this and approved it. So, you know, it wasn't all our fault, basically. Mm-hmm.
So we can assume that had that not happened, the settlement would have been higher.
Yeah, you'd imagine if there was a more rigorous FDA process, you would wonder, would this drug have seen the light of day at all, first mm-hmm. and foremost? But you would imagine that the settlement would have been higher if there was a stronger approval process that the Sacklers couldn't kind of point towards, as saying, well, you know, we did everything right, basically.
And listen, talk to me about the reputation laundering, because the Sacklers have long been accused of that because they have been philanthropists, haven't they?
Yeah, long time major philanthropists. They've donated to the likes of the Guggenheim, the Met, Yale, Harvard, Cornell, as well as the Louvre, Tate Modern, King's College in London, all sorts of buildings and wings named after the Sacklers over the years. And people say this is part of an attempt made by the family to appear charitable and kind, to distract from the harm that was being done in their name for profit. And those donations have continued up to recent years. The British registered Sackler Trust pledged more than $6 million in 2022. Organisations, though, less willing to say that they're accepting money. In the past, it was kind of a badge of honour. You were getting money from the Sacklers, not so much anymore. And another interesting, though, bit of reputation laundering through the Sacklers attempted to do was to completely distance themselves from Purdue Pharma. Despite it being owned now multiple generations of the family, they keep their name away from the company, the marketing, the publications. They avoid mentioning where they're getting the money from when they're making their charitable donations. So usually you see companies are only delighted to be able to talk about, you know, family owned and, you know, a long history and all that kind of stuff.
Doesn't
you don't
anymore.
See that with Purdue at all. They don't mention themselves.
Look, it's a fascinating story, but it ended in such tragedy for so many people who were victims of OxyContin. Adam, thanks so much for bringing that to us. That's Adam McGuire. Back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.